Good afternoon, everybody. We are going to start, so I see a few members. If you could take your seats. Welcome to a special Twilight edition of the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. Representative Morrow will remember when the Cincinnati Reds played in Riverfront Stadium. They had what's called a Twilight Night doubleheader. So the first game was around this time of day, and then they played the regular nightcap. But we're not going to have a Twilight Night doubleheader today. We're going to be hopefully done. Our meeting time goes till 6. I know that we have a couple of longer bills. We're going to allow, of course, for reasoned public debate and discussion about this, but it's my intention that we will go no later than 6:30. So I'm still thinking and confident we'll be able to get this hearing in by 6, but so you can plan your evenings, members and members of the public. We will go no later than 6:30. So a couple of other housekeeping items before we start. I was hoping there'd be a few more members here for this announcement, but I might have to repeat it. I spoke with Senator Murphy yesterday after our hearing on distracted driving, and it's the Senate's intention to put together a omnibus transportation policy bill. I am going to have some pretty tight rules about how this bill gets put together. It's somewhat based on my mentor as a chair, Representative Holberg. And we are going to do an omnibus policy bill, but we're not going to hear any, we're not going to have a markup session with amendments. We are going to hear these bills. We're going to pass them out either to the floor or to other committees. And by next Thursday, any bill that's been heard by the public and passed by this committee, then we'll put together an omnibus bill. We may take a few technical amendments related to those bills, but we're not going to open things up and have amendments. I feel strongly about this because the public really needs to be noticed, and we have notice requirements. So members, if you want something heard, you're going to have to get that in the hopper by tomorrow, because we have bill introductions on Monday, and then that's going to be it in terms of this committee. We're going to have meetings on Tuesday at this time, on Wednesday at our normally scheduled time, and then our last meeting before the policy deadline, which is officially March 12th, will be on Thursday evening, the 11th, here. Now, there is a slight chance that we may meet on St. Patrick's Day because of any Senate bills that we need to hear. I don't know how likely that is. If it happens, it will probably be a brief meeting that day. After the 17th, this committee won't meet. We've done our informational hearings. We will have done our work in terms of policy bill hearings. So keep that in mind. And this really goes out to the general public and to the agencies. I know that there's a couple of agencies that have some things outstanding. Please get those bills to the hopper at the Speaker's office tomorrow, and for introduction on Monday. So that's really, and we're it. We're down to the deadline. We're done. I am going to accommodate people that get bills in by tomorrow, but no later. So again, to review, Tuesday the 9th here at 4:30, Wednesday the 10th at our normal room and time at 1 o'clock, and then our final meeting potentially for the for this session is going to be on the 11th at 4:30, and then that's barring any activity we have to deal with in the Senate. So are there any questions about that from members? Okay. Well, our first bill of the day is House File 2956. I'd like to call on the author, Representative Kunin, to make a presentation. And I'll move this bill be recommended to pass and sent to the consent calendar, if there's no objection. Welcome to the committee, Representative Kunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And also, before we start with the bill, I'd like to amend the bill to deal with the enactment date. And I don't know if your staff has some language for me on that.
Okay, I think that in the process of being distributed.
Okay.
Okay, so members, this is the, I'll move the HRD1 amendment. Representative Kunin, to your amendment?
I believe it's just supposed to move or make this, the enactment date, you know, I'm not sure. I haven't seen the amendment, but I think it's supposed to step it up so it doesn't...
Mr. Burris, do you want to take a crack at this?
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would make the bill effective the day after enactment.
Okay, so that was just standard procedure with our bills. It was just not in the bill. So then, members, all in favor of the HRD 1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. The bill is before us in the way the author would like us to consider it. Representative Coonan.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 2956, what it does is, well, first of all, let me start by saying current law allows the commissioner at MnDOT to convey land no longer needed for highway purposes to political subdivisions or state agencies. And what this bill does is allow the commissioner to do the same for Indian tribal government by adding Indian tribal government to this section in statute, and that's section 161.44, subdivision 1. And so that's pretty much what it does. It's all permissive language. It doesn't mandate the commissioner to do anything. And that's pretty much what the bill does. I have with me today Chairman Kevin Jensvold from Upper Sioux, and he's going to explain a little bit of the project and why this is necessary to the committee. And well, we'll just let the Chairman Jensvold take it from here. Then.
Thank you very much, Representative Coonan, and Chairman Jensvold, welcome to the committee.
Please state
your name for our record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Jensvold. I am the chairman of the Upper Sioux community located about 120 miles west of the metropolitan area. And I want to thank you as well as Representative Coonan for advocating on behalf of a situation that occurred or developed that the tribe had proposed to build a new road to alleviate a safety concern where traffic to our gaming enterprise utilizes State Highway 274. And the junction is on County Road 44, Yellow Medicine County Road 44. And through studies, we determined that we could mitigate the safety factor by creating a tribal road and to join to the State Highway 274. We had conversations with, I believe his name is Dave Truen, the district engineer of in Wilmer, Minnesota. And we had developed plans and were moving forward when it was brought to our attention that in order to move ahead that we would convey to the state of Minnesota a new right-of-way because we would have to shift the current right-of-way of 274. In doing that, we had asked the state and then in turn to convey back to our tribe those acres that they were abandoning, and that's when it occurred to the state that that wasn't permissible by state law. And that is the essence of our concern and our request today. And to reiterate what Representative Coonan said, it is not something to mandate, but it's at the leisure of the commissioner that we ask that this be considered because we do believe it will mitigate certain safety concerns and also enhance the traffic flow in that area. So I thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for hearing that.
Thank you very much, Chairman Jensvold. Are there any questions for the chairman? Okay, seeing none, any discussion? Okay, Representative Coonan, any final comments you want to make before we vote?
No, just thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for hearing the bill today.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Coonan. And I will then renew my motion that House File 2956, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Coonan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next bill on the agenda is House File 3072, Representative Bingham.
Right. I got to get into this one.
fired up now. This is her reelection bill.
And I will, it's good to have Representative Seifert on the committee. I will recommend that House File 3072 be recommended to pass, and this one will go to the General Register. I believe, do you have an amendment, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have a technical amendment from MnDOT, the A3 amendment.
Okay. Members, we will consider first the A3 amendment. Do you want to explain that to the committee then?
It's a technical amendment to get it in the shape that I would like. It was just a request from MnDOT to make sure the language is clear for them. So.
Okay.
I can explain the bill first, or I would prefer to have the amendment moved so it's
okay,
in the form.
Well, let's do that. Members, to this H3072A2 amendment, all those in favor?
A3.
A3, I'm sorry. A3 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Okay. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please, to the bill, Representative Bingham.
With me today, I have St. Paul Park Police Officer, Officer Felix, who can explain the premise or the reasoning why he contacted myself and Senator Seaman regarding this issue. What House File 3072 does is basically clarifies it's that in statute that if you're in the left lane, you have to keep in that lane or go to the centermost lane. And it is how our driving manual says, it was just vague in the statute. So we're just making sure that our driving manual is consistent with statute. So with that, I can have Officer Felix explain what happened to him and why he feels this is necessary to change.
Okay, well, welcome to the committee, Officer Felix, and just state your name for our record, please.
Is Robert Brian Felix. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm police officer with the City of St. Paul Park. Been a police officer approximately 3 years. I'd like to go into a couple things about this, reasons why I contacted the Senator and Representative about this. First of all, my understanding of what the current law is regarding to the Minnesota Driver's Manual and then my personal experience. I feel that the laws that are in statute along with the Minnesota Driver's Manual should be consistent. First looking at right turns regarding the state statute and right turns regarding the driver's manual are both consistent. When you leave the area you're going to be turning from, you should be to the right-hand curb, close to the right-hand curb, and when you enter the nearest the next roadway, it should also be next to the right-hand curb. That's consistent in the driver's manual along with the statute. The left turns, it's inconsistent. For the driver's manual, from what everybody's taught, you should leave the intersection to the right of the center line, nearest the center line, then when you make that left turn and enter that next portion of the roadway, according to the driver's manual, it should be to the lane nearest to and to the right of the center line. But the statute just says you need to be to the right of the center line, which leaves it very vague, very open, meaning if there are 6, 7 different lanes, an individual could turn to any of one of those lanes. And I feel that's a very big hazard to have. If individuals can turn to whatever lane they want to, anybody making right turns could be in danger and collisions could happen because of that. Now getting to my reason for contacting the Senator and Representative. Back September 2008, I stopped an individual for what I felt was an improper left turn. They entered the roadway and entered the furthest right-hand traffic lane, which I felt was a violation of state statute. I stopped the individual. He was showed signs of impairment. He was arrested for DWI. Subsequent testing showed that he was a 0.22 alcohol limit, which is almost 3 times the legal limit. Further research showed that this was his 5th DWI that he had had in 9 years. 4 of those 5 DWIs, I apologize, I don't have the statute or the stats for the 5th DWI because it was in Wisconsin, but 4 of those 5 DWIs, including mine, the minimum alcohol concentration he had was 0.22. This was an habitual DWI offender. He wasn't learning from the mistakes, and now the DWI that I arrested him for was a felony level DWI. When it went to trial, the defense argued that the individual did not do anything wrong because he did turn to the right of the center line, but not to the nearest lane to the right of the center line because the statute did not say you needed to do that. The judge agreed, and the case was dismissed, And in the judge's findings, if I can quote him, he said the statute, the reader is confused at best as to the conduct that the statute seeks to regulate. So, obviously, the judge agreed that the statute was very vague and needs to be it needs to be amended, in my opinion, and more specific to what conduct that the driver is supposed to be doing. In conclusion, I just feel that it's a tragedy that this individual, who is an habitual DWI offender and a risk to the public, got off with nothing. And I feel that this law needs to be changed just so this does not happen again. And, Mr. Chair, members, any questions? I'd be.
Yes, I know that there are some questions already. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Officer, I'm Representative Erdahl. Is that name familiar to you at all?
No, sir, I apologize. It does not.
Glad that my brother in St. Paul Park isn't giving me any trouble. But let me continue seriously that I have some problems with this, and that I appreciate the person who you stopped for the DWI, but you have to explain why you couldn't have just arrested him for drinking and driving, not for making the improper turn. But my larger concern is this. I'll just give you a specific example. When I come off 94 under the Marion Street exit, I stay at the Kelly Inn. That's my home. And I go to the right lane when I'm making my left turn out of that stoplight, because I've only got one bridge span to get into the right lane. Immediately after the stoplight, at the over the bridge span, there's a road, and then right away, with about a 10-foot boulevard, is my turn into the Kelly Inn. In other words, by this law change, I very easily would not be able to make my turn.
Yes, sir, I understand your concern. My point about that is, what if you were making a right turn and then you had to turn left across that bridge span? There's already a law saying that you have to turn from right curb to right curb. I understand if you have to do that, and if you were ever stopped for that, I personally can say that's an officer discretion decision. If you were stopped for that and you explained that this is why you did it, me personally, I would understand why you did that. I would not prefer that you would do that, but if you're saying that that's your reason to do that, that's an officer discretion choice. But there's already a law set for the right turns, and that's why I'm saying I feel law should be in place for the left turns. And I understand where you're coming from, and that's if you were ever stopped by that, that would be something you could speak with the officer who stopped you for that violation, and they could use their discretion about that.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you're you're an understanding officer, I'm sure, and I would be able to make that turn. I'm worried about some others out there. But again, can you give me some other examples of how this is a problem? I just don't know that from the one thing that you said that this is a problem.
My main concern is I would like to know that every individual knows what lane specifically to turn in for safety reasons. I will give you an example. Let's say an individual continually makes that turn into that far right lane. If they're sober, that's one thing, but my concern is if they're intoxicated. From my experience, an intoxicated person is more concerned. They get that tunnel vision about having to get home, and that's all they're concerned about, and they're going to resort to the driving conduct that they habitually do. What I mean by that is if an individual is going to be making a right turn the same time as that person is making a left turn, they're going to be focused more on just making that left turn, and they're not going to be focused on what lane is safer to be traveling to. And that's why I feel it should be important to tell the people what lane to turn into so they can safely make that turn, and then that person making the right turn will not have their safety jeopardized as well.
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Officer. Frankly, I don't know that if someone is intoxicated, they're going to be making those determinations.
Officer Felix?
One thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Riddle. It's also what Officer Felix is suggesting, and hopefully we'll be able to do today, is make it consistent with the driving manual. Because what he's saying is that we're all taught when we get our license in Minnesota a certain way in the driving manual. That is not consistent with what the statute is. So that's the other issue at hand here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the officer, Representative Riddle drives a Jeep Patriot.
Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3072, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Okay, so we are now on to the next Representative Bingham bill.
Yep, and I was
thank you, Officer, for your testimony. This is House File 2888.
Yes, and Representative Morrow will be joining me up here in a in a second here. Well, members, this is a bill that for a while now has gone through this legislature, and so we're not going to have too much testimony in here, but this is a very bipartisan, bi-geographical bill. What this is current under current law, you really only have two options if you are driving carelessly and heedlessly, and that results in the death of another. That's either a felony, which you have to prove gross negligence for, which is a very high threshold, or else a misdemeanor, which is the same as running through a stop sign or failing to yield. And my concern is that when we ought to have more justice than that, when the life of somebody else is taken because you are carelessly and heedlessly disrespecting and with disregard the rights and safeties of others. So in the committee's materials, you will see that there is a letter from Dakota County Attorney James Backstrom, who's been a longtime advocate of this, talking about the difficulty and the adequate of justice when this happens. Also, the city of Minneapolis and Ms. Susan Segal sent a letter along in support of this. Members of Abate are supportive of this. The organization St. Clair Valley Riders are supportive of this. Nancy Johnson with the Council of
Minnesotans for Safer Driving.
Thank you. Are supportive of this. And so just ask that in a favorable vote for this today to move it along. And if Representative Morrow has anything to add, we can always stand for questions. And Representative Garofalo has also been extremely helpful in this and has worked every year with me on this. So I want to note the bipartisanness of this too.
Mr. Chair. Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrow, you have a bill as well. Is this similar bill to what you have?
Yeah, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Riddle. I do what we decided, rather than running multiple bills, that I would join with Representative Bingham, because I believe, and I've been supporting Representative Bingham's bill now for several years, and my belief that judges need more options in sentencing when death is caused in these type of tragic accidents leads me to be here today.
Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bingham, Representative Morrow. I know that I am signed on to your bill, mm-hmm. and am supportive of this. I've talked to the ABATE folks quite a bit about it, and I think that it's an important piece of legislation.
Thank you. I'm going to call on Representative Davids and Representative Champion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the author, Garofalo, I see it. This is a bipartisan bill. I'm one of the others on there.
Yeah.
And the reason is because this really affected a constituent in La Crescent, Minnesota. And after having visited with her for some time and talking to the author, I hope this will go out with no dissenting votes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I might just on
Representative
that.
Representative Morrow.
Representative Davids, I want to extend my hand out to your constituent as well. I had a chance to talk with your constituent after the last hearing. Now, in the last committee, the committee had heard the testimony last year. And I want to know that my heart goes out to your constituent. I had a long chance to talk with her, and I do hope that we're able to move this bill on her behalf, on her son's behalf, and on the other family members.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Morrow, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Champion.
To either one of the authors, can you just tell me, isn't it already possible for the court, if they wanted to extend sentencing of an individual, could do so by there being aggravating factors, or if they wanted to go downward, there would be mitigating factors? Isn't this already possible under law?
Representative Bingham?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, I'm not a lawyer yet, and so I am in that process of applying and all that stuff, so I'm going to let Representative Morrow handle this because he is a lawyer. But what I will say is that this is the prosecutor's discretion on this. Whether I know that you and I have spoken, and you have some concerns about things being an accident. Well, the prosecutor has discretion, and they use that. And this is another option, in my opinion, as Representative Morrow said, that they can use to bring appropriate justice to the tragic loss of, you know, Representative David's constituent. I've had constituents. County Attorney Backstrom has done numerous, if you read his letter, it has had numerous cases where it's just that threshold is really hard to meet. And when you walk out and you've lost a son, a daughter, a friend, a spouse, and they hear that, unfortunately, the only thing we can give you is a misdemeanor, which is the equivalent of running a stop sign. That's tragic. And so I really want to fight for the victims in this case. And if I believe Representative Morrow can explain the legal precedent, maybe in a few years I can help you out then.
Thank you. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Morrow. Okay, Representative Morrow, why don't you respond to Representative Champion first?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Champion, I know you have had a little bit of chance to talk about this already, and in part, I would defer if you could direct me to where there's already the adequate measures. I'm taking my lead in part from the paragraph one of the letter from the Dakota County Attorney that tells us the existing statute's inadequate, in part because there's the limit to one probationary year maximum, and as the county attorney describes on page one and top of page two, a longer probationary period might be appropriate, for example, in the case of treatment, anger management, psychological treatment, might want to impose more than 90 days in jail. I understand from both the city attorney in Minneapolis and from the county attorney that they don't feel that the judge has these options. If there is another venue, I'm certainly open to hearing more about it, but in part taking the lead not only from the motorcyclists, the bicyclists, and the Minnesotans for Safe Driving and the attorneys here, it seems that they don't feel that the judge has those options at the moment.
Representative Bingham and then Representative Champion for a follow-up.
Okay, sorry. Well, the one other thing I would add is that when you talked about the severity and enhancement stuff, there are already, if you go to County Attorney Backstrom's letter, he talks about that the severity of the crime depends on the injury or cause. There are other statutes that do this with assault and others.
Representative Champion.
Just for clarity, there are the sentencing guidelines, and whenever there's something that falls within the sentencing guidelines, the judge has the option, especially if it's argued, whether to deviate from the sentencing guidelines. Therefore, if they are presented with aggravating factors, they can consider those and deviate, as well as upward or downward. And I'm just feeling as if we're putting something else on the books where the court already has the ability by which to do it. And it doesn't mean that I'm not sensitive to victims. And I heard you earlier, Representative Bingham, say that you were just concerned about victims. We're all concerned about victims. But we're also concerned that we don't want to increase the number of statutes and additional information in these books that we don't necessarily need. And I just feel like the judge already had the power and the authority to do that.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Champion, to that, it's that the threshold is so hard to get with the gross negligence that the only option they have is the misdemeanor then. And so this is a middle ground of that. And that's really what we're doing here.
Yes, Representative Champion.
Last thing I'll say.
That's good.
I'm not suggesting that the threshold for the gross negligence is not a high threshold, right? I'm only suggesting that whenever you think in terms of any charge, it could even be gross negligence. They could charge them with gross negligence, and someone else can, and the judge still have the option of saying, well, the sentencing guideline says I'm only supposed to go between 1 and 3 years, but because of aggravating factors that have been presented to me, I'm going to now sentence you to 5 years. The judge has that option right now. And I'm just suggesting that maybe that's something that we should continue to support. And that's all I'll say, because I don't want you to think I'm not supportive of what you're trying to do. I just think it's...
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Champion, the problem is they don't have that middle option right now. There is no punishment level of gross misdemeanor right now for this. It literally is, you meet the gross negligence threshold. If you don't, it's a misdemeanor. So there really is no middle ground. And that's just what, unless you have something else to add, but that's our point of the bill.
And committee members and members of the audience, you are now eligible for one continuing ed legal credit for your legal education. We're going to have Representative McFarland, and I know Representative Welty has a question as well. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On June 1st of 2008, I lost two constituents who were hit head-on by a 17-year-old that crossed the median and hit them. And it took a year to find out they only gave her careless driving. And I'm just wondering if you could clarify for me what would happen in the case of a juvenile, somebody 17, being the careless driver.
Our distinguished panel of attorneys, who wants to take this one?
Just for clarification, I'm not a lawyer.
I know, but you will be soon.
I am a paralegal, and I think I could charge for something for another.
Representative Bingham has completed law school. Representative Morrow, you'll
take
this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McFarland. Representative McFarland, I don't see that there's a difference in the treatment drive, but I'm not in the position to give that legal opinion. I don't know if Mr. Burris or someone else is able to answer that, but I'm not in a position to be able to answer what happens in the case of juvenile. I don't see anything in the statute that tells me that they're treated differently. No,
that's Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have an easy answer because it's actually a fairly complex area of law. Juveniles are treated differently, and the penalty structure depends on the type of violation. It would take some research for me to really give you a good answer on that, but it wouldn't necessarily be the same penalty for a juvenile.
Right, and that, Mr. Chair, and that's what I've understood after going through it for a year with my constituent, that juveniles are treated differently, and so just curious about that.
Okay, good question, Representative McFarland. Representative Welty, and then Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Bingham and Representative Morrow, I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. It was just a couple of years ago that a constituent living only a couple miles down the road from me knew the family well. They were traveling in a minivan, and someone came through an intersection, T-boned the minivan, and killed their daughter while they were traveling. And the family contacted me, and we spent a lot of time dealing with, there were a lot of different circumstances in the case of this accident, which we were able to work through over quite a period of time. But in the end, the one request that the mother had was that the person who ended up went through that intersection, the officer and the others weren't able to bring the charge that the mother felt was necessary in this case. She also didn't feel that this person should be charged with a felony, but thought that there was something that should be in between. And in the end, after a lot of counsel that we had with the local county attorney's office, and then also with the State Patrol and others got involved, they ended up pointing us towards this bill. And they said that this bill is needed in order to give you that step in between. And so if others are hearing that this is needed, and I know where you're coming from. I just feel that if we're hearing about this from many different areas of the state and many people are receiving guidance that this is needed, then I definitely support this legislation, and that's why I've signed on.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Welty, as well. You're right, we're hearing many stories of this type around the state. I think we do have someone who can speak to Representative McFarland's question.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify your name for the record.
My name is Sharon Gurman Driscoll. I'm the victim advocate for Minnesotans for Safe Driving. Mr. Chairman, committee members, you asked about the juvenile. I have a case that's on right now with a juvenile who killed someone, and that charge is careless driving, and the same thing is coming out of it. The county attorney, we spoke and said, I wish there was something else, but it is being, because it's driving sentence, it will be the exact same way, and that we just don't have the threshold to move up. And on the, as a victim advocate talking about the sentencing guidelines, which I certainly respect, when it comes to careless driving, there is no sentencing guidelines, none at all, because we can't reach the threshold. So thank you very much.
I appreciate your coming forward with that testimony. Representative McFarland, any follow-up? Okay. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where's this bill going? It sounds to me it shouldn't even be in here. I thought public safety.
No, it's going to the general register.
Correct.
And I believe it's been to public safety already.
It has been?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we're amending public safety language?
No, there's no amendments, but because this has to do with traffic safety issues, we're giving it a good discussion here.
A good legal here.
Yeah. So
we really appreciate your time in hearing the bill.
Mr. Chair, I do think it's important because we did have a little confusion just in terms of if there was any public testimony. I don't know of anyone here who's here to testify in the bill.
Yeah, we'll ask the committee if they have any further questions of the authors, and then if not, is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to the House file? Okay, seeing none and seeing no further discussion from the committee, thank you to both Representatives Morrow and Bingham. I'll renew my motion that House File 2888 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you to both authors. And
we didn't ask.
Oh, sorry. Any opposed?
No.
Okay. Sorry about that. Representative Welty. House File 2920. And I believe this was not in your packet, members, but it was passed out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee as a member and to your testifiers. You have the motion, right, Representative Welty?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we move House File 2920, and I believe the motion would be to send it to Commerce Committee?
Yes.
Commerce Committee.
So you can proceed with your bill. I believe you have an amendment as well.
Yes, I do. Mr. Chair and members, the amendment that you have in front of you is 2920A1, and this is simply language to get the bill in the form in which to debate it. So at this time, I move 2920A1 amendment.
Okay. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2920 is a bill to really clarify the definition of a motor vehicle. This issue kind of came about back in 2005. Some language was moved around, as I understand it, in renumbering of statute, and therefore there were possibly some unintended consequences of that. Because of that, there was a court case that came about, and so the reason why we are here today is to provide clarification and to define motor vehicles so that hopefully in the future there's not ambiguity around this issue. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the two testifiers here, and first testifier will be Amber Bacchus, and she is here on behalf of the Minnesota Truckers Association.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Bacchus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus, and as Representative Welty said, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trucking Association, a statewide organization representing motor carriers of all sizes and the vendors that serve the trucking industry. And we are here to clarify some things with regard to the definition of motor vehicle when it comes to the vicarious liability statute in Minnesota law. Since 1945, there has been a law in the books that says when someone else is driving the vehicle besides the owner and there is an accident, the owner of that vehicle is on the hook. In the trucking industry, we've interpreted that to mean that the motor vehicle owner is the owner of the tractor, trailer, and the trucking company that has the authority for that vehicle. There's another bill moving last year that somewhat would change that, and we just want to say that if the definition of motor vehicle used to interpret the vicarious liability statute includes a trailer, we still want to make sure that the tractor and trailer are considered one motor vehicle for liability purposes. We don't want them considered two separate motor vehicles. That would just completely change the framework of how the trucking industry operates today. And with me, I have Doug Law of Dart Transit to discuss the problems with imposing liability on trailer owners for responsibilities that they do not have under the current regulatory framework. The motor carrier is the one responsible for the safety fitness of the driver and of the vehicle. The load is moving under the motor carrier's authority, and both the liability and insurance requirements follow that scheme. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Graw to provide more details.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Graw, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Graw. I'm in-house counsel for Dart Transit Company and here on behalf of the Minnesota Trucking Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity. In its most basic intent, any form of liability is based on whoever actually does the act, whoever is responsible for the damage should be held responsible for the damage. With motor carriers, we take on that responsibility. We're the ones that inspect equipment every day, and when we inspect equipment, we inspect the tractor and the trailer. That means we inspect the tires, that means we inspect the brakes, that means we inspect the lights, the hoses, everything that goes inside and outside of those tractors and trailers, we inspect. The federal regulations say we have to do that. We take on that responsibility, we carry that insurance, and we're responsible to the motoring public. If you're driving down the road and a tire comes off of a trailer while we're operating it, we're responsible, not the trailer owner, because it's our insurance and we're the ones maintaining that and taking care of that. It was our responsibility to make sure that wasn't going to happen. We were in a position to prevent it. In the event, though, that an injury is actually caused by a trailer, let's say it was faulty maintenance on a trailer and the trailer owner did something wrong, this bill isn't going to do anything to prevent a plaintiff from going after that trailer owner. All the common law torts against a trailer owner are still applicable. This just means that if the driver did something wrong, that's the motor carrier's responsibility. Okay, this would also apply outside of the trucking industry. Imagine you loan your boat trailer to your neighbor while he hauls the boat up north. If he's in an accident, if we don't do this, you could be held responsible as the trailer owner for his actions when he drove recklessly with that truck. And that's what we're here to do, is basically to clarify that whoever's actually does the act, whoever actually causes the damage, should be the party that's held responsible. And that's why we'd encourage you to support this bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Graw. Are there any questions of the author or the witnesses? We do have an additional witness as well. Okay, Mr. Carlson is here. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, which is an association of attorneys that represent consumers, many of whom are injured in car accidents, and that is what our association, part of our members do. As this bill moves forward, Mr. Chairman and members, I want to make something perfectly clear to this committee. There was no intent by Representative Holberg or anyone else to make a separate liability for a truck and a trailer. Representative Holberg is carrying a bill. It's House File 127 and Senate File 251. And the amendment that you just put on this bill is the entirety of Representative Holberg's bill. We are in agreement that definition is what has applied to motor vehicles. and is what should apply to motor vehicles. And that includes a trailer when it's hooked to a self-propelled vehicle. We are in agreement on that. The confusion has arisen over a simple renumbering in a bill, in a data practices bill that Representative Holberg carried in 2005. And a court case was brought, and the court determined that because the definition in 169, where this section is now located, does not include a trailer, there is no liability on a trailer, even if they are negligent. There is simply no liability to them. All Representative Holberg's bill is trying to do is to just put the old definition back in place. And when I read from the Trucking Association that they're on their website that there is a change in the works to consider a truck trailer, a truck tractor, and a truck trailer as two separate motor vehicles, that is just absolutely not true. And I know Representative Holberg doesn't have that intent, nor did we. You need to know that since 1932, at least, that's as far back as I can find, Minnesota has always considered a trailer being pulled by a motor vehicle as one unit. And I'd cite one brief case for you. It's National Indemnity versus Ness. And this is black letter law that has been true in Minnesota as far back as I can find. Under the facts of this case, any attempt to separate damages caused by a tractor from those caused by the trailer would be futile. The trailer was dependent on the tractor for movement. The two must be viewed as one unit. That is the law in Minnesota. We didn't change that. We didn't seek to change that. The other provisions of this bill, we believe, are close to restating what the law is, but they are written in a confusing manner. Section 1 of the bill is what the law is right now and what the law always has been. They are viewed as one unit. That is unnecessary language. The amendment they just put on the bill is Representative Holberg's bill, and the bottom part of the bill that talks to a single self-propelled vehicle connected to or towing one or more trailers is close to what the current law is, but it does need to be cleaned up as it relates to an owner versus an operator and what the liability is of a trailer. But this is not necessary right now in law. That is a separate issue. What the legislature needs to do is pass Representative Holberg's bill into law as quick as you can, because the status of the law right now is that there's no liability on trailers because they are not motor vehicles. That's what needs to be fixed. And these other issues, as they move forward, we're happy to work on them. But the critical point that the legislature has to do is pass that bill of Representative Holberg's, and then work on whatever clarifying language you want to have relative to the Safety Responsibility Act. But the first thing we need to do is get that bill passed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Happy to answer any questions. But just to be clear, no intent to have them as two separate units.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Are there any questions of Mr. Carlson?
Well,
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, and I kind of feel like Alice in Wonderland falling through transportation into civil law today with some of the issues that are on the agenda. And I think that it's been clearly stated. I think the Trucking Association is trying to make sure that there's no standards of liability that are changed. And I think that all parties are willing to work with each other. You know, and so hope this has been contentious, but it really shouldn't be. And now that I've heard everybody at the table say they're willing to work together, I think that's a positive sign. I'm guessing that after this bill goes to Commerce, it's probably going to go to civil law as well, and or additional language be amended to my bill, which is sitting on the floor, whatever seems to make the most sense. So I don't have any questions, but I, looking around the room, saw a lot of confusion on people's faces. So thank goodness I'm not an attorney, and hopefully you understood my explanation. Yes.
But Mr. Chairman and members,
Mr. Carlson,
you know, the confusion is detrimental right now, and thankfully we are in agreement. They just put it onto this bill that the definition of a motor vehicle that applies to that chapter is exactly what you tried to do last session, and that needs to be passed as soon as possible, because right now they have no liability, and we need to fix that.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And, you know, as chair, I've been monitoring this, and I was very, very relieved to hear the last couple of days that there had been some agreement, at least temporarily, in terms of moving this forward. And it's also my understanding that this amendment is not mutually exclusive of the author's intent or Representative Holberg's original bill be incorporated in here. So I would like to see this move on to Commerce and Civil Law and make sure that any other outstanding issues are dealt with. But we have anyone want to discuss? Yes, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson, I just want to be clear on these last three lines. The operator of the motor vehicle is deemed to be the agent of the owner of the self-propelled portion of the motor vehicle combination. I get that. And not an agent of the owner of the trailer portion of the motor vehicle combination. Therefore, who is liable for that second part?
Mr. Carlson, and I also know Ms. Backus wants to respond as well, but Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, this isn't my language, and I think that it's unclear. But we would believe, close to what the current law should be, is that the trailer owner, if they have liability, is responsible under this scenario. I don't think the language is quite clear enough to get it there yet, but we would understand the trailer owner to have liability under this language, if they had liability, and that the operator of the motor vehicle would have their own liabilities if it relates to the cab. What this doesn't address is if I am the owner of the cab, not the operator, the owner of the cab, then I believe I'm responsible for both. And that's what is unclear with this language that needs to be fixed.
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Carlson, and whoever else. I think that's an important thing that, as this moves along, gets clarified and we know what it is.
Okay, and then I believe Ms. Backus wanted to respond as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm probably going to muddy the waters a little bit here because this section of law that we're amending is dealing with vicarious liability when someone else is driving the vehicle that doesn't own it. So Mr. Carlson's concerns about the owner here aren't relevant. And what the V case, which was the impetus for the Minnesota Association of Justice, the V case, that was the impetus for the Minnesota Association of Justice pursuing their bill last year, what that case was trying to do was make the trailer owner responsible, and I'll read from the case here, the V, who is a plaintiff, sought to hold the trailer owner, APL, vicariously liable for Abraham's allegedly negligent driving. I don't know of any case law before this that supported that. Yes, the definition of motor vehicle included a trailer, but it wasn't making a trailer separately liable for somebody else's negligent driving. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're seeking this clarifying language and asking that the operator be deemed the agent of the self-propelled portion of the motor vehicle, not the trailer portion of the motor vehicle. That would be a new precedent as far as the trucking industry goes. That would expose the trailer owner to these claims where they don't have insurance against them right now. So it's a liability issue and then correspondingly a coverage issue that just hasn't been there any time as far as I'm aware. And Mr. Graw might be able to help out if you'd like a little
Mr.
more clarification.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify one point real quickly is if the trailer actually, the motor carrier would have controlled whether or not the trailer could have done something wrong. The most likely event of a trailer doing something wrong and causing an accident would be the motor carrier not maintaining it, okay? And the motor carrier under federal law has to take care of that. They have to maintain the insurance for those kind of things. That's what we accept as for responsibility. So in that context, if the trailer actually doing something wrong, we're going to be responsible as the motor carrier.
Okay, Representative Erdahl, do you have another question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just a quick one, just a comment, so I'm sure that I understand. I'll say that, you know, I own the trailer. I have it reviewed and inspected and everything. It's just fine. Representative Morrow is out there driving the tractor in my trailer. Has an accident. I then could be sued for the negligent driving of Representative Morrow if my trailer had some impact in the accident.
That could potentially happen if this definition were to change and there wasn't any language saying that for liability purposes, the tractor and trailer together are one motor vehicle. That's what this V case was trying to do, was to make you negligent and liable as well, or make you liable for that negligence as well.
And the driver...
And to be clear, with this renumbering, Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, to be clear, just because of this renumbering, that would not happen today, because the courts have determined that a trailer is not a motor vehicle and is not responsible. That needs to be fixed.
Representative Morrow.
I'm trying to remember which committee we're on, Mr. Chair. Because I think this is a difficult issue, which I agree with Representative Holberg. I think the bill still probably needs a little bit of work because it involves questions of vicarious liability versus direct liability. This is not the Civil Justice Committee. I don't know that we are equipped or given the charge of resolving that issue. That as a policy question, I think we're just trying to figure out what the definition of motor vehicle is and allow the liability questions at least to be discussed here. I think we should be informed, but at the same time, remember our purview, because we're not in a position to resolve, I think, unless we're going to take another law school class tonight, talk about direct and vicarious liability.
It's a point well taken, Representative Morrow. Thank you. So we do want to at least keep some of our discussion centered around that motor vehicle definition. I know the lawyers want to get going. I see Representative Champion there, but
Mr. Chairman and members, I don't think
Mr. Carlson.
I don't think there's any disagreement that the definition of a motor vehicle is 65B.43 subdivision 2. We're all in agreement on that point.
And I appreciate that. And so I think that at least for the transportation policy portion of this bill, we appear to be in good shape. But I wouldn't want to prejudge what the committee wants to do. So is there any further discussion? So this bill will be going to Commerce and then Civil Law, and I imagine would have to do that relatively quickly. But for our purposes, we've, I believe, successfully fixed that definition. So is there any further discussion, and is there anyone else in the public that would like to testify either in favor or in opposition to the House file? Members? Seeing no further discussion, then I will renew my motion that House File 2920 as amended be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much. Thank you for your efforts to come together on that definition. So we have one final bill tonight, and certain... Oh, okay. Before, as people are kind of getting situated for our last bill, Representative Leader, we have several different minutes to approve. Wednesday the 24th, and our hearing yesterday, March 3rd.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes of February 24th and March 3rd.
All those in favor of approval of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. So, members, we have one last bill, and again, we would like to get done as close to 6 as possible. If we have to go a couple minutes over time, we will, but not much over that. And want to give everyone who has an interest in this bill an opportunity to testify and, of course, give the committee ample opportunity to discuss. So, with that, this is Representative Swales' bill. And Representative Swales, do you want to move your bill? I believe it needs to go to the Commerce Committee after this.
Yes, Mr. Chair. If I might, I would like to move House File 2804.
Okay.
And it looks like there is an amendment, the A1 amendment.
Okay, members, does everyone have the H2804A1 amendment? Would you like to explain the amendment, Representative Swales?
It's pretty self-explanatory on line 1.2. It simply moves to strike the word rates, tariffs, or the word or.
Any discussion to the amendment? This is the way the author would like us to consider it. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. The motion prevails. So we now have House File 2804 as amended before us. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I simply want to introduce this bill. It has to do with the rates that household good movers must file. It's a tariff schedule with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I have sitting here with me Mr. Lee McGrath, who is going to explain the bill.
Mr. McGrath, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman,
state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much. I'm Lee McGrath. I'm the executive director of a public interest law firm called the Institute for Justice. One of the things we do at the Institute for Justice is to lobby and to litigate in ways that knock down barriers to entry for entrepreneurs. And this is one of our projects this year to get rid of a barrier into the field of in-state household goods moving. What I'd like to do today is tell you what this bill does, which is a small explanation, and tell you what this bill doesn't do, which is a little bit bigger of an explanation. What Representative Swales' legislation does do is it ends a paper process. It ends a process that today requires in-state household goods movers to file papers with MnDOT that state what the household goods movers' rates are. It repeals that requirement and ends that responsibility that they ship paper to MnDOT where it's filed in a filing cabinet. No other mode of transportation in Minnesota has this requirement, and there are three important reasons as to why you should support Representative Swales' legislation. First is that movers don't use these rates to give quotes. We have surveyed the industry, and movers are responding to competitive pressures. They're not using these rates anymore. Secondly, movers don't update these rates. We have looked at all the rates in MnDOT and noticed that nearly 80% of them have not been updated in the last 2 years. And thirdly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, MnDOT does not proactively enforce compliance with this law, compliance with these rates. In essence, the current requirement serves no purpose in that the rates are not being used, not being updated, and they're not being enforced. Importantly, though, and let me turn to what this bill doesn't do. Importantly, this bill is not a radical deregulation or a reduction in consumer protection in Minnesota, because papers filed at MnDOT and stored at MnDOT do not protect consumers. Specifically, Mr. Chairman, this bill does not end the requirement that movers be licensed. They still need to be licensed in Minnesota to operate in-state household goods moving business. Secondly, it does not end the requirement that movers carry insurance or be bonded. They still have to carry that. Thirdly, it does not end the requirement that they submit their prices to consumers. That is still a rule at MnDOT. And fourthly, it does not change the inspection of these movers by law enforcement and the state patrol. This is a tiny bill dealing with filing of rates on paper to MnDOT and nothing more but a paper process that we hope to eliminate and reduce a bit of a bureaucratic, unused process. The reason we're interested in doing this is that it will increase price flexibility. It will allow movers to offer discounts to seniors, to students, and to frequent users. It will allow movers to compete for customers the very same way that every industry in the state of Minnesota does, every other industry, which is by offering the best value of high quality and competitive prices. In your packet, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have supporting written testimony from Jim Hovland, who is the mayor of Edina and a transportation attorney for over 20 years, and from Jim Hardman, who has been a transportation attorney for over 49 years. So we're very appreciative of this opportunity to do this very small thing and ask the committee for its support of Representative Swales' legislation. I'm happy to answer any questions
the
committee
might
have.
We do have at least one question, maybe more. Representative Erdahl.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McGrath, I don't know if you can answer this question or someone from MnDOT, but I'm wondering how our system here in Minnesota compares with other states. Is this something across the country that the rates have to be filed with the transportation office? What do our surrounding states do?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Erdahl, I can answer that.
Please state your name for the record as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hadn't been formally introduced. I'm Catherine Schaefer. I'm working with Lee McGrath at the Institute for Justice. I'd like to thank all of you committee members for taking the time to meet with me over the past months. But back to Representative Erdahl, to your question, I've contacted a number of Department of Transportations in what I consider the sprawling Midwest. And of the states that I talked to that do not have the filing process currently in place where they do not have to file their rates, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Maryland, and Florida were the five that I had contacted. I contacted about 15 states. I just, like I said, it was the sprawling Midwest, if that answers your question.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Ms. Schaefer, so of the 15 that you contacted, how many do require this filing of rates?
It was 10. So of the five of them do not still file their rates, and 10 do.
Is there any additional questions? I have one if there are none. Oh, Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at this last page here, and it talks about discounting to seniors, renters, and frequent users is prohibited. Can you tell me how that works? I mean, why? I mean, as a business owner, if I want to run a senior special on Wednesdays, I mean, why can't I do that as a mover?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. McGrath,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbert, what these two statutes do is prohibit the very thing that you would otherwise do as a regular business person. They fix the rate in which you're supposed to charge. That is a fixed price that you're supposed to follow after you submit it to MnDOT. You are prohibited by law from changing that price. That's the only price that you're allowed to charge. Now, what has happened in reality, however, is that this is a healthy and competitive industry with good players in it, but they are not the majority of them are not following that rate. They are responding to market pressures. And so in that regard, the fixed priced filing exists in law but is not being followed.
Representative Holbert, did you have a follow-up?
I'm just confused.
Yeah, well, I think that we'll probably at some point hear from MnDOT, but I guess my question then, and I appreciate how much time and effort that you've put into this. I know that you've been working on this very hard, and when we visited my office, I think even before session started, I had raised a concern about the impact on consumers, which you responded to, anticipated. But I still have that concern, and I guess based on your testimony today, my question is, if this is, you know, kind of paperwork that isn't used, that no one's checked it for 2 years, et cetera, I mean, philosophically, it's helpful to have disclosure and have a public agency publish that. But if it is true that this is not even being used and ignored anyway, then why is this causing so much of a problem?
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we try to do at the Institute for Justice is look for laws that act as barriers to entry, that hurt companies that are trying to start a startup, put unnecessary roadblocks in their way. This is one of those regulatory requirements that can cost a new company a couple hundred, possibly even $1,000 to file their rates with MnDOT. It is an unnecessary an unnecessary barrier to entry into this industry. And so it's for that reason that we, and the fact that it's being ignored, it is for that reason that we think it is wise to get out of this paper process and allow it, let the regulation that is really oriented to health and safety, licensure, insurance, inspections, let that stay, but get rid of this paper process.
Okay. Representative Holbert, are there questions?
One quick question here. Could this process be used for industry price fixing, if you will? I see on your sheet that you show that the MnDOT, movers call MnDOT 100 times a year to check competitors' rates. To what degree could they all kind of get together and say, let's all stick to this amount, and given that very few have been changed in the last 2 years, given the volatility of fuel, what does that say about competition in the marketplace?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Holbert, I do not believe there is any collusion going on in this industry. It previously filed rates, but it struck an agreement with the FTC about 5 or 6, 7 years ago, and today each individual carrier files its own rates. And so I don't believe there is any collusion. I know of no evidence of any collusion going on among the providers.
Representative Holmer? Okay. Is there any other? Representative Champion?
Isn't that true that the reason why there's this whole notion around submitting your information to MnDOT was something that the Trucking Association asked for themselves? Isn't that right?
Mr.
McGrath.
Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, this is an ancient regulation. It dates back to the idea of common carriers during the 1930s. This law was put in place in 1957. It was common at that time to protect the trucking industry from competition so that it could grow and develop. Now, we've seen a revolution in trucking and transportation law led by first the Kennedy administration and then the Carter administration, in which lots of these regulations were gotten rid of. But this is a in Minnesota, this is over a 50-year-old law.
I'm still waiting for the answer to my question. Wasn't this something that the Trucking Association or trucking industry asked to have done?
Mr.
McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, I don't know the history in Minnesota from 1957 as to how this came about. I do know of the regulatory philosophy from the 1930s, which was to limit price competition in the industry. I'm sorry.
Thank you so much.
Members, if there are no additional questions, I feel the need, we're going to have testimony from supporters and opponents. So, but before that, since MnDOT is kind of the object of this bill, as you were, and I don't see MnDOT testifying either for or against, I actually do have a couple of questions and would like MnDOT's perspective on it. So I think I see Mr. Udine, Mr. Peterson, the household goods movers expert now coming to the table, and I... Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and any testimony you have.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ward Briggs. I'm the Director of Commercial Vehicle Operations at MnDOT, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. I guess my first question is, does MnDOT have a position on this bill, either in support or opposition?
We have concerns either way, but we're neutral. I think, if you boil the testimony down, once you've heard everything, you'll hear one side say that this is a system that really isn't consulted very much by anybody. It isn't used much by consumers, and therefore it can't protect consumers. It's old and it's archaic, and that's true, I think, to a large extent. On the other hand, you'll have testimony from the industry that will say, in Minnesota, we're unlike a lot of states in that we just really don't have any problems with household goods movers. Other states have deregulated to one extent or another, and problems have risen. There are a lot more complaints in other states. So MnDOT doesn't get complaints about carriers' rates and the service that they provide. So I think it's really just it's a policy call and a judgment call. None of us can predict the future. So if we got rid of this, it's possible that everything would be fine. If we, on the other hand, it is possible that some problems could arise in the future.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you. And I just maybe a little history and refresh my mind, or correct me if I'm wrong, but over the years, this has been a really contentious policy issue. And my recollection is that there was a level of fencing or limiting of new players into this arena, if you will, for a number of years, in which new household movers couldn't get into the business in Minnesota because of the structure of the regulation. And a couple years ago, I think it was Representative Earhart had a bill in which we and there was I remember an issue with two men in a truck were trying to do charity work, and mm-hmm. people were saying they couldn't do that, and there was a lot of consternation. And so if you can confirm or correct my recollection, and then let us know if there's been any major problems since that policy was changed, if we've seen more competition, if any of the horrible things that were predicted had come true.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, you have a very good memory. Your memory is accurate. This has been actually one of the first years I was with MnDOT. Betsy Parker and I tried to deregulate the household goods industry. We had a bill, or were working on one, in 1995. and it's been somewhat contentious on and off since then. A couple of years ago, Representative Earhart had that bill, and it did remove all of the entry barriers. It did everything but remove the rates and tariff filings. And at that time, we had serious reservations about doing that. We had talked as that bill was being developed, and we were working with Mr. McGrath and Representative Earhart, and MnDOT's preference at that time was to see some consumer protection regulation put in place of the rate and tariff filing. And that's what I testified to at that time. That didn't happen, and the rates and tariffs stayed in place. And we haven't really had any problems since then. At the federal level, they still retain rate and tariff filing, and they have a lot of consumer protection regulation in place to avoid the foreseeable problems if you have a complete deregulation. But to directly respond to, have there been all sorts of horrible things that have happened since deregulation? To my knowledge, there haven't been.
All right, thank you.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, you know, you just mentioned the fact that at the federal level, they also require these rates to be filed. And I remember there was a bill that I think we're going to be taking a look at, or we already did, regarding the license of or the filing of waste, the transport of waste, and we just took that up this year, and
yep.
I think there's a move to possibly get rid of that because it's already being done federally. So if it's already being done federally, what's your opinion as to if we got rid of it here?
Mr.
Briggs.
Representative Welty, the federal regulations apply only to interstate carriers, and to the extent that our carriers operating in Minnesota are operating interstate, it already applies to them. To those that operate solely within Minnesota, they aren't subject to those federal regulations.
Hey, I have a question if no one else on the committee has any additional ones for MnDOT. One last one. What is the, Mr. Briggs, the fee for movers, the filing fee? I think Mr. McGrath mentioned that was fairly onerous. And how long is the form that has to be filed?
Mr. Chair, there a fee for filing a tariff?
Yeah, I believe there was a fee that Mr. McGrath referred to that, no, you didn't, did I hear that wrong? Or?
No, I understand. I think the question is, Mr. McGrath stated that it costs, a tariff really, if you look at it, looks like an insurance policy. It's long and it's got a lot of fine print. And the carriers can choose the rate that they want to file and charge. So nobody's telling them you have to charge this rate. But once they file a rate, they have to charge that rate.
No, I guess maybe I misunderstood Mr. McGrath's point. Is there an administrative fee, and is there an onerous form that anyone has to fill out? It seems like that was a concern of yours, Mr. McGrath, if I did heard that correctly.
I'll try and answer more directly and then turn it over to Mr. McGrath, Mr. Chairman. The carrier has to file a tariff because it's a complex document, like an insurance document. They either have to draft it or have it drafted. That would be by somebody that does this for a business, and they'd charge a fee. MnDOT doesn't charge a fee
okay.
to have it filed.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Briggs is absolutely right. The fees and the costs that I associate that I stated earlier in my testimony are fees paid to outside consultants and lawyers to prepare the tariff filing that over at MnDOT could be a couple of inches thick or just a few pages thick.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then so my last question is, are these typically a couple of pages or very thick?
Mr. Chair, typically I think they look more like an insurance policy, maybe 25 pages or something like that. Mm-hmm. It really tries to cover every eventuality. If you read one, you'd see that there's a certain fee for moving certain types of fixtures or whatever. There's a certain fee if there's, depending on how many stairs have to go up and down or whether there's an elevator available, and all the eventualities, so that in theory somebody could read this tariff and figure out what it was going to cost them to move based on the document.
Okay. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the MnDOT testifier. When's the last time anyone actually checked to see if a mover was charging the proper fees or the fees that they have listed?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Mr. McGrath was correct when he said MnDOT doesn't proactively go out and enforce this. We've over the years worked on different safety programs as they've come in, and we've taken on a lot of work and gotten away from what we used to call economic regulation as things have been deregulated. We do respond to complaints when we receive them. Usually we respond by making a phone call or visiting the carrier and pointing out what the law says, and that usually solves it. That's relatively infrequently, but it is true that we don't go out and just and actively follow movers around at moves and see what they're charging and that type of thing.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the complaints you received, have they been complaints about the rates being charged?
Mr. Chair, Representative, excuse me, I didn't understand.
The rate that you said you've responded to complaints, have these complaints involved the rates being charged by the carriers?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they can be about anything. Typically, they're oftentimes about things that we can't do anything about, like the movers moved my furniture, but the dining room table showed up with a nick in the top or something like that, and that isn't anything that we can do. Occasionally, we'll get safety complaints, concerns about the equipment that was being used. Occasionally, we'll get a complaint about a rate or that a carrier didn't charge a filed rate, but all of these complaints are relatively few in number.
Okay. Thank you, members, and thank you very much, Mr. Briggs. Are there any additional questions of Mr. Briggs? Okay, what I'd like to do now, members, and to those in the public that are interested in testifying this bill, is to take a testimony from those in the public that support the bill and then opponents. Why don't we take those who support the bill first, and then we'll move to opponents. And again, it's my intention that we vote on this no later than 6:30, so I'd like everybody to keep that in mind in their testimony. Please make it as succinct as possible.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Fruin. I'm an associate professor of marketing, transportation, and logistics in the Applied Economics Department at the University of Minnesota. I'm also a faculty scholar at the Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies and the University Extension Specialist in Transportation. Thanks for the opportunity to speak in favor of House File 2804, a bill that removes the archaic regulations that require Minnesota household good movers to file tariffs with the state DOT. Please note my comments and opinions expressed here are my own and do not represent an official position for the university. I have been a student of transportation economics and transportation issues since the 1960s. Consequently, I followed the transportation deregulation debates that started in John Kennedy's administration and culminated with the substantial deregulation of air, rail, and truck at the federal level during the Carter administration. Household goods then were subsequently deregulated a few years later at the federal level. And as I say, I've been a student of this issue. I remember all of the horrible things that we heard about what would happen if we deregulated the trucking industry, this industry, that industry. And that really didn't happen. Economic deregulation of transportation meant allowing the free entry of firms into the businesses and the freedom to set prices. We didn't do anything about safety and consumer protection, things like that. Those rules stayed in effect. And if House File 2804 is passed, the state of Minnesota will still regulate all aspects of vehicle safety and provide the fundamental consumer protection laws. That is, the state will still issue permits and set rules for safety, insurance, vehicle inspection, and use its authority to enforce contracts to protect the public from fraud. And I think that's a key point, that we're now on contract issues and not a tariff filed at the state that everyone will use, subject to a $200 penalty if I deviate from that, if I do want to give a senior discount or have a special, or say, hey, let's use my trucks during the middle of the week, during the middle of the month when people aren't moving, I got a special rate for that time. This would allow that without the fact that, in fact, I would be breaking the law when I did that. So this legislation does not reduce consumer protection. It just reduces an unnecessary and unused regulation that creates an anti-competitive barrier to entry. Transportation economists and economists generally almost unanimously agree that there are tremendous benefits to the U.S. economy and our national well-being resulting from transportation deregulation. There have been extensive studies and documentation showing and recording that major benefits have accrued since deregulation, from cost and energy savings, improved and more flexible service, and new and innovative products. I encourage and urge the committee to pass this legislation. The current requirement that household goods carriers file tariffs with MnDOT is an unnecessary cost to the firm and to our economy that does not contribute to the state's ability to protect the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions of Professor Fruin? Thank you, Professor Fruin. Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify in favor of the House file? Okay, please state your name for the record, and again, please try to make your comments succinct.
My name is James C. Hardman, and I have submitted written testimony, and I don't
want to go over that. Yes, you're from Little Canada, I believe.
Yes, but after 49 years of law and management experience in the motor carrier field, I feel that the changes that were brought about by not requiring a entry a proceeding has changed the complexion of this, of the industry, and we should be working to get rid of things that are not a benefit to any party. I want to make a few comments. There was some testimony here that on the interstate level, the tariffs have to be filed. That's not really true. The household good movers that are involved in interstate commerce have to have a tariff, but they don't file it with the federal DOT, and they just have to make it available to a user of their service on reasonable request. And then if there is some reason for the federal to have the tariff, they can request it. There was also some testimony about the cost of tariffs. You can go on the internet and you'll find that it's quite common for companies to give you what they call a standard tariff for about $1,500. And if you want a custom tariff that has to comply with certain procedural things, you're talking usually around $2,500. And every time you change the tariff, you get similar charges. I think the characterization of the tariff to an insurance policy is quite correct. And like most people without the background, educational background, they have a difficult time of understanding what an insurance policy means. And that's also true with tariffs, that I would suggest that most people have no idea when they see a tariff and how to understand it. And tariffs is a term really that has no meaning in fact. There's no standards that we have to follow and so forth. In the interstate level, they are only required to set forth items that spell out what you're going to transport, how much you're going to charge for it, and other little matters. And if that is the function of a tariff, it's people do that as a matter of course in their dealings. With that, I would open myself up for questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Hardman. Are there any questions of Mr. Hardman? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
With that, I think we'll now move to several opponents of the legislation. I'll just say who has signed up. We have Howard Marcus, followed by Mike Gorgon, Paul Keel.
Quayle.
Paul Quayle. Jeff Bruhn, Paul Lentz, John Archibald, and Reese Ledger. So,
if it's possible,
we welcome your testimony, but
somebody that couldn't be here.
Pointed as possible. I want to give you equal time as well, but since there's so many of you, we'd like to just have the testimony as complimentary as possible. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Marcus, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Howard Marcus, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Transport Services Association. To be honest with you, everything that was said today, I'm not sure whether I should start by discussing specific issues that were brought up, going in reverse order, or go with my prepared remarks.
However you would like to testify.
Well, maybe I can clarify one or two things. One of the things that Mr. Hardman said was that the cost of filing tariffs is on the internet is $1,500 to $2,000, $2,500. This is not the case in Minnesota, number one. It's a little closer to what Mr. McGrath said, somewhere between $200 and $600 or in that range, if they hire a professional to do it. A carrier has a right to do the tariff themselves. They can, and then all it is their own time and effort and, you know, paper. And filing with MnDOT, so it's not something where you can look at it and say this is a specific cost. That's really not correct. Our economics professor, and I apologize, I should remember his name, but I don't.
Dr. Fruin.
Sorry.
I would assume, right?
I'm not.
Yes, he has his PhD. Okay.
I'm not very. I'm a little nervous, so you'll have to excuse me. So. One of the things that he talked about, the economic benefits of things like discounts and things like that. First of all, I've been in the transportation industry as a consultant for 35 years, so I don't have as many stripes as Mr. Hardman or the professor, the doctor. But I do remember when discounts first came out, and when they came out, one of the first things carriers did was they raised their rates. They raised their rates, gave a discount, and basically the net effect was zero or an increase. So it's really a false premise to say this is going to be an economic benefit of any sort. One of the things that kind of, I apologize for jumping around because I'm kind of dealing with some of the things that were said, and I'll get to my prepared remarks, which probably won't take more than a couple minutes. First of all, I want to make it very clear to the committee that that movers in the state of Minnesota are not licensed anymore. That was eliminated 2 years ago. Now it's a registration process. So basically they fill out a two-page form, they pay the fee, which is $125, and they're household goods carriers. Now they do have to fill out the other requirements, obviously. They have to have insurance, they have to register a vehicle, and they have to have the tariff. But there isn't any barrier to entry for licensing anymore. And the tariff itself is not a barrier to entry. It's just another cost of doing business. It's just codifying the rates as if you put it in your website or anywhere else. And most businesses would agree with that. I'm going to kind of get into my own spiel here. And you can ask questions or we can turn it over to some of the members of the industry. The Minnesota Transport Services Association is the Household Goods Trade Association for the state of Minnesota. For the record, obviously I'm in opposition to House File 2804. The bill proposes to repeal Minnesota Statute 221.161, Publication of Tariffs, and 221.171, Filed Rate Doctrine. What it really does is it'll eliminate household goods tariffs. I want to focus on a few issues that I believe are key to the bill. First of all, we have a system in Minnesota that is working. I don't believe that anyone can really say otherwise. The real test of a regulatory system dealing with consumers is the number of complaints that the industry receives. In Minnesota, there are three main groups to file complaints with concerning household good moves. These are the Minnesota Department of Transportation, the Better Business Bureau, and the Attorney General's Office. We have no knowledge of any complaints being filed with the Attorney General's Office during 2009. Only one complaint was filed with MnDOT, and I believe the number given by the Better Business Bureau in their Senate testimony was 46. And the Better Business Bureau number was down, I believe, by about 30 or so complaints from 2008. And I apologize, we had thought the representative of the Better Business Bureau would be here, but unfortunately she couldn't attend. So we really don't have a problem with our existing system. But I'd like to look at a few of Mr. McGrath's points in favor of this bill and see if we can see the other side. His main arguments were movers don't use the rates, movers don't update the rates, and MnDOT doesn't proactively enforce the rates. Taken in reverse order, MnDOT does not proactively enforce the rates. They've never been charged with proactively enforcing the rates. They're there to deal with complaints more than anything else. Even when MnDOT was regulating freight carriers, they weren't required to proactively enforce the rates. So this is really doesn't make any difference. Movers don't update their rates. The carriers have the right to update their rates whenever they want to. We have what we call a permissive rate filing system in the state of Minnesota. So if a carrier feels the need to change his rates, he can do so at any time. There's no requirement that they have to do it in any given interval, and if they choose not to do it for a year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever the case may be, their rates are based on their cost and their competition, and if they determine they don't need to, who better than their own business to determine what they need to charge? The other one's dealing with MnDOT does not use, or excuse me, that the movers don't use their rates. This one's a little bit harder to talk about. First of all, his contention was that 80% of the movers surveyed did not quote based on their filed rates. MTSA has no knowledge of what carriers are doing in their internal operations, and quoting of rates is an internal operation, and you can discuss that with these folks up here. I can offer a few thoughts concerning this. First of all, there's 144 registered household goods carriers in the state of Minnesota. According to what I heard in the Senate testimony, they surveyed 20 of them, and they said that basically 80% or 16 of them were not quoting the rates. And it was based on what Mr. McGrath's person said they should be quoting. I'd like to offer just the following, and maybe some of the carriers could, talk a little bit more about this. Just a few possibilities. It's possible that the carriers had a fuel surcharge that they had published to their tariff, and when they're quoting their rate, they included the fuel surcharge, which would be different than the rate that Mr. McGrath's person might have seen on the page. It could be that perhaps Mr. McGrath's person, not being familiar with tariffs, could have misinterpreted what they were told or what they saw in the tariff. It's possible that because of the economy, that the carrier's personnel that answered the phone should not have been the person giving the quote, or they misinterpreted what was asked or gave what they thought was the proper answer. Carriers can give you a lot more in-depth answer to that.
Hey, maybe we should move on to those, if you can maybe wrap up your testimony, Mr. Marcus. You can move on to the carrier.
Basically, I just wanted to just say a couple more things. I only had a couple more things to say. I'm sorry the Better Business Bureau cannot attend today's hearing. In testimony in the Senate Transportation Committee, Dana Badger, the president of the BBB, stated that Minnesota had a very small number of complaints concerning household goods carriers, especially when compared to states and locations that had removed or relaxed the regulation of the industry. Complaints are really an after effect. With the current system of tariffs, what we have is the teeth in place to benefit consumers before the problem arises. In closing, tariffs are important because consumers have the option to verify the rates of legal carriers with a trusted state agency. As regulations are relaxed, the records in other states show an increase in the amount of individuals and companies who are classified as rogue movers or scam artists. These are individuals who look for opportunities to prey on the vulnerable. They like situations where there's no economic regulation, as it provides more opportunities for unethical practices. These are not companies who hire Minnesota workers, pay taxes, train workers, and provide background checks like the legal household goods industry. As an industry, we oppose this bill, and the state and the leading consumer group, the Better Business Bureau, are on record in the Senate as not supporting this bill. More than happy to answer any questions.
Okay, well, thank you. My question you just answered with your last sentence, which is I wanted to just be very clear that it's your understanding that the Better Business Bureau, as I assume of Minnesota, has a position on the record in the Senate in opposition to this bill.
It's not... They're not allowed to say that whether they're in favor or opposition of a bill. That's against the rules.
Okay,
but they're not
so
in favor. They do not support the bill.
Okay. So they oppose the bill.
Mr. Chair, he says they're not allowed to say they support or oppose it, but they don't support it. What I think I heard is that they're not allowed to take positions on legislation.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Well, then, can you just clarify what, just maybe in a sentence or two, the Better Business Bureau's perspective is?
It's my understanding the Better Business, according to the testimony I heard in the Senate, the Better Business Bureau's perspective is basically the system is working, there's very few complaints. In looking at other states that they can pull up complaint records from, Minnesota is virtually complaint-free, where we do a wonderful job, and they don't see a reason in making any changes.
That's helpful. Thank you very, very much for your testimony. Next person, I think maybe Mr. Ledger, would you like
sure.
to go?
Okay.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee, and I know, Mr. Ledger,
Chair,
you had some challenges getting here, and I really appreciate that you're here
to
testify on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Reese Ledger. I'm here to represent Teamsters Local 120, the largest Teamster local in the state of Minnesota, and the fifth largest in North America. You've heard from academics, you've heard from lawyers. I like to speak on behalf of the people that actually roll up their sleeves and do the work and oppose HF 2804. Passage of this bill will endanger the jobs and jeopardize the wages, health care, and retirement benefits of Teamsters employed as household goods movers. It will also jeopardize industry standards that afford movers, union and non-union alike, membership in the American middle class. This will be an unfortunate outcome for a workforce that consistently delivers a level of service praised by consumer advocates such as the Better Business Bureau. Furthermore, passage of HF 2804 would imperil an industry. Currently, minimal regulation of the household goods moving industry results in stable, law-abiding employers providing a high quality of service. Without reasonable MnDOT's oversight, the industry will likely fall prey to fly-by-night operators and raise the specter of issues like worker misclassification and immigrant exploitation. Finally, passage of H.F. 2804 would threaten families. Currently, household goods moving companies like Metcalf and Berger conduct background checks on applicants, document citizenship, and screen for drugs and alcohol. These companies build long-term relationships with their employees, whose average tenure is 15 years. At the here today, gone tomorrow operators envisioned under H.F. 2804, workers may only be known for 15 minutes before giving full control of the valuables and complete access to the homes of families that are moving. In closing, I'd like to say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I would urge this committee not only to vote against H.F. 2804, but also get back to the important business of creating the type of quality jobs that our members and other movers currently enjoy in the household moving goods industry is currently structured.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Ledger. I guess there's no ambiguity about where the Teamsters Local Union 120 stands on this bill. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, sir, can you tell me what worker misclassification is and how that could hurt the consumer?
Sure. Worker misclassification is a situation where instead of employers treating their employees as employees so that they get the types of benefits and also the types of protections that they're entitled to as employees, those workers would instead be inappropriately classified as independent contractors and therefore not subject to everything ranging from minimum wage laws, the health and safety laws, to EEOC protections, and everything along those lines.
Okay. Representative Holberg.
And if I might, given the testimony that you heard today from MnDOT about how they barely even look at these tariff pieces of paper and that there is a need for a licensure form to be filled out and certain standards to be met, Is it your testimony that a fly-by-night would take care of the licensure portion and just because they didn't have to fill out a tariff that they'd be unregulated, or?
Mr.
Ledger.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Yep. I apologize.
Yep. Okay.
Representative, I think that the prior testimony very conveniently minimized what it is that's required in filing for a tariff. My understanding that a bill of lading includes basically an overview of how it is that particular hauler or moving company does business. And we like to think that that requirement forces an enterprise like Metcalf or Berger to go through the exercise and be able to lay out to the state the way that it does business and to make sure that it's doing so in a responsible way. There were only three words that I agreed with in Mr. McGrath's testimony, and that was remove responsibility. And I'm here to make sure that that doesn't happen or to do my best to make sure that it doesn't happen. Our worst concern is that what will happen in the house goods or the home goods moving industry is what we've seen happen in other industries, where we've seen companies that have historically provided good, stable jobs to people that they call employees appropriately, suddenly transform due to deregulation into companies that's where they have employees one day that gets, again, all the protections that I talked about that are afforded employees. With deregulation the next day, all those people that were formerly employees suddenly become independent contractors who get none of the protections that I described.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't understand how not having to fill out 25 pieces of paper that sit somewhere for, at least by this testimony, for 2 years, never being altered, changed, and rarely looked at, does that. I have a business in which there are lots of fly-by-nights, okay? Mm-hmm. And consumers are pretty savvy, believe it or not. I mean, most consumers, before they hire somebody to put all their stuff in a truck to drive it down the road, are going to ask about things like insurance and whether the contract looks valid. They may even go online, check Angie's List, look for some ratings, call the Better Business Bureau. And I know in my line of work, certain cities require licensure, so they check for insurance. And it's pretty easy in most cities to do that. And I'll guarantee you, if you're referring to fly-by-night movers, just like fly-by-night tree trimmers, they are not filling out the paperwork at MnDOT. They're not doing any of this. So, I mean, you still haven't made the case for me why this not filing just this one piece of paper all of a sudden makes your industry just this big, huge risk to a savvy consumer.
Sure. Mr. Ledger. Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I would suggest that the savvy consumer that you're talking about makes some assumptions. Make some assumptions about what the minimal standards that carriers, or the, in this instance, home movers, have to live up to, because the state requires them to. Very similar to how the state requires electricians to live up to standards, or other licensed trades to live up to standards. And I also point out that I think that it's very important that those assumptions are held to be true, because in this industry, the industry that we're talking about, not only are we entrusting the valuables of families to fly-by-night operators, we're also entrusting access to their homes and to their children. And I think that it's important that the state live up to its responsibility.
Okay.
I also think
Mr.
it's interesting.
Chair, can you just one second? And just mm-hmm. tell me, because you don't fill out 25 pieces of paper, mm-hmm. what standard of safety or liability is affected by that? MnDOT still has oversight because of the licensure part of it mm-hmm. and standards. We have laws about liability insurance. We have, you know, standards about all kinds of things that are not related to this tariff. That's, you still haven't convinced me that because I don't put in a rate card, there's no other standard that you guys are held to, whether it's from MnDOT or your own industry or the insurance industry, et cetera. There's no other standard being changed here other than some pieces of paper being turned in relative to price. So if it's all about the money, then that's one thing. But if it's something else that's for the safety of the consumer, I'd like to hear it.
Sure.
Mr. Ledger, and then
sure,
we'll
absolutely.
Move on from
yes, thank you.
Mr.
Thank
Ledger,
you for your
please.
Questions, Representative. I do appreciate the opportunity to discuss our differing ideas, I guess, on this issue. I would just suggest that, you know, I think that this, again, I think that the tariffs, just making it sound as though it's just about money, actually involves more than that. And I'll leave it to the industry to explain what's involved in a bill of lading and a filing there. I would also suggest that somehow we went from it being overly burdensome to it just being a simple thing that we really shouldn't overly determine whether or not, you know, it's a good measure of distinguishing between a good, reliable mover or a fly-by-night operation. So, you know, our feeling, obviously, is that, in fact, the requirement to file with the state will help to distinguish and help those savvy consumers make up their minds in terms of which responsible hauler they're going to use.
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to make sure words are not put in my mouth. The point I'm making is 25 pieces of paper does not mean that I'm adhering to safety standards if my brakes have been inspected, etc. So don't mix it up here. You know, I'm just saying the pieces of paper don't guarantee consumer protection. That's the point I'm making.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to maybe delve into this a little further, but if we could just have the two more representatives who are in opposition either respond to this, make your own comments. We'll go a couple minutes past 6:30, but I don't want to go too much longer. So, but I wanted to give you the opportunity. Thank you very much, Mr. Ledger,
Thank
by the
you
way.
Very much. Appreciate it.
So please, if you could each step up, identify yourselves for the record. Brief testimony, if you want to respond to some of the points that Representative Holberg made, that's fine, but please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Paul Coyle. I work at Action Moving Services in Burnsville. I passed out a sheet prior with some just key points on it earlier. I would just like to address Representative Holberg's question of what does 25 pieces of paper do at the state? And from a discriminatory standpoint, it guarantees you a rate. Okay, everybody thinks that rates are going to go down if we do away with tariffs, but no one looks at if rates are going to go up for seniors because they're unable to move themselves. You know, anybody could walk in there and look and say, you know, Action Moving Services quotes our rates daily, and we use our tariff daily. But anybody else who doesn't could walk in and look at an elderly person and go, well, we usually charge $190 an hour for four guys, but you live in a $2.1 million home and you're on Minnetonka, so I can charge you $250 and you're probably going to pay it. You know, you have to look at everything. What rates do is guarantees a price. And that's, if you have any questions for the flyer I handed out, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Okay. But thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the testifier. If what you're saying is true, I'm provided with information that says that Minnesota has the highest moving rates in the country, 30% higher than the national average.
Yeah, and I'd like to know where those numbers came from. I would like to defer this question to Jeff, who did a little research on it, too.
Okay, so this is Mr. Brune?
Yes, Jeff Brune.
Identify your name.
Jeff Brune with Reds Transfer in St. Cloud.
Wonderful.
Proceed. I took a little offense earlier at the Senate hearing about Minnesota rates being 30% higher than the national average. Mr. Marcus is a member of the State's Transportation Association Directors. There is no known study to that organization of place of rates. The American Moving and Storage Association has no knowledge of that as well. I had an office member make 5 phone calls to 5 different states today just to ask what their rate was for 2 men and a truck. Like, they were a customer just asking, what do you charge for 2 men and a truck per hour? Iowa is $2 an hour more than we are. Nebraska, $19 an hour higher. Illinois, anywhere from $2 to $52 an hour higher. Nevada, $6 an hour higher. And North Carolina, 50 cents an hour higher. To Representative Erdahl's question, I don't think we're 30% higher than the national average.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. figures that we have are provided by Mr. McGrath. Perhaps he can answer where he got his figures.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Erdahl, those figures are correct. We verified those in 2 ways. One is after checking the entire body of all 140 or so tariffs here in Minnesota, we went down to Iowa and we looked at all of the 80 tariffs there. Additionally, and so we confirmed that the average rate in Minnesota was significantly higher than that of in Iowa. Additionally, we've talked to the largest franchisor, that is two men and a truck. It's based in Michigan, and they have been very supportive of the work that IJ has been doing to reduce these barriers to entry, and they gave us that information based on their research and what their franchisees around the country charge. And so their industry is competitive in all the markets. This gentleman runs the St. Paul franchise for two men and a truck, and it is the chief operating officer at Two Men and a Truck with whom I've been dealing, and his organization is the source of that finding that Minnesota has the highest rates in the country.
Okay. Representative Erdahl, and then members, I'm going to extend to for another 10 minutes, but I feel we've had a good debate. I want to make sure everyone who wants to testify on the record has that chance, but I feel people do have the information they need to vote, which is the bottom line here. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just real quickly, so I just heard from, I believe you, sir, that yes. You cited a half a dozen or so that you had contacted, 5. Mr. McGrath, once again, how many contacts were made by you regarding this?
Well, we had 2 major studies. One was the work that we did ourselves by going into all of Minnesota's tariffs and all of Iowa's tariffs. That was over 200 tariffs that we surveyed. Additionally, we spoke and got the research of the largest franchisor who has franchisees across the nation and who reports all of their rates into their headquarters in Michigan.
Wonderful. Representative Erdahl, your last question, because I think
this one's
here of this study and the point counterpoint. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This one's really quick and a bit unrelated. I'd just like to know, how many times in a year do you change your rates? Anyone can answer.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you very much. Mike Gorgon, as it's been said, I do own a two-minute franchise. I'm also the chairman for the MTSA. Just to note, I've changed my rates twice in the last 18 months.
That's all. Okay. Thank you. With that, then, why don't the both of you conclude and proceed, conclude your testimony?
Just one more point. I understand Mr. McGrath saying that there's the 30% the cost of moving services here in Minnesota create barriers for people to do business here. Is that what you said, sir?
Well, let's go through the chair here.
I'm just saying.
But what I would like to do, members, and why don't both of you conclude your testimony? We'll have a final comment from Representative Swales. I don't know, Mr. Ledger, if you had anything additional, and then we'll proceed.
Well, yes. Mr. Chairman, I can't add a whole lot more than what has been said. Just to reiterate, just back to the old fashioned: if it isn't broke, don't fix it. Again, if this was a problem, we'd have a lot more complaints, and we don't.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for your time.
Yes, and we have, please proceed.
I'm just concluding. Yeah. Few points to glean from everything else, and I got to tell you, the questions we've been asked today have been very insightful, and I can tell some people have done their homework on this, so it's good to hear. Real quickly, we talked about barriers to entry. That was, as Mr. Ward-Briggs said from MnDOT, was done away with Representative Earhart's bill, I believe, 2 years ago.
Representative,
that was the last of the barriers. Now, and I actually got my at the time it was a licensure authority prior to that without a problem. As there are today 144 movers, that's actually fewer than 2 years ago. Unfortunately, that's probably to do with our economics. I'd like to say again that of the 15 states that were asked about who do require filed rates, we heard that five have abolished that. Two of the five, though, are trying to re-regulate, Maryland and Florida, and this is where the Ansel evidence from the Better Business Bureau came into effect. They rate 25% of their moves in Florida generate complaints, and people move a lot. I don't believe it's because the people in Florida are any less educated or not bright or not savvy consumers, but sometimes people will prey on certain populations and certain demographics that can be prone to that, and people often retire to Florida. I just think that's something that's a compare or contrast for our state today. And finally, we talk about, is 25 pieces of paper really relevant in today's business? I think it's very comparable to myself going out and filing my own LLC documents without having an attorney look at it. Well, I file it, it goes somewhere, it sits there. But at least I know I'm a legitimate company. At least somebody, if they wanted to, can check and see I'm a legitimate company. And it's the same exact thing here. If we don't have a true and correct system for putting rates somewhere, and where else we put that, but with the state government, because that's where it affects us, how are you going to know if I don't have three different sets of true and correct copies in my office for somebody? It's the bait and switch we worry about. It's really the reputation. At the end of the day, it's just something that builds trust. And because we're the only industry that takes everything you have, puts it in a truck, and drives away, trust is a big deal. So when you have somebody who isn't doing something right, I'm all for going after them. If it's somebody who is doing something right, don't mess with it. And I'd hate to see 50 years of just because it's old, let's throw it out kind of thing. That would exclude a lot of history, as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to see us tear down a dam that's been working so long just because we think the water's still going to stay up, because it's really hard to push that water back up behind the dam when it's done. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience, the public here, that would like to testify either in support or in opposition to the House file? Okay, I'm looking around. I don't see anybody. So I'd like Representative Swale. Oh, Mr. Kane, are you? Representative Swale, so you get the last word on House File 2804, I believe, unless any members have any additional questions of anybody. I think we've been thoroughly briefed on this bill. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the reason I decided that I would be the chief author of this bill is that my work over the last year looking at ways to streamline government and to create more efficiencies, this seemed to fit in with that theme of things that I was trying to achieve. I was guaranteed that this was a little bill, and it's not. So,
Everyone beware, whether it's the state or interest groups, anybody, there's no such thing.
But I do deeply appreciate the patience of the members who have sat through this very engaging debate, and I leave it to your will on whether we move this forward. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Representative Swales. And again, thanks to both the proponents and opponents. It's my view that any bill that generates this level of interest be thoroughly vetted, and I think we've had that discussion today. So, members, thank you. We are ready to vote. Representative Welty renews his motion. Representative Swales. We did that one already. Representative Swales renews her motion that House File 2804 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The chair is a bit in doubt here, so I will ask for a division and raise of the hands. All in favor of the Swales motion, signify by raising your hand.
Say for two.
We don't have proxies for those things. Okay, all opposed? Okay, there are six members in favor, six in opposition, so the motion does not prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, wait, hold on. Did you count so?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, don't listen to me.
Thank you. Okay, members. Thank you very much again. I will reiterate, members, just please, we're just about ready to go. Not everybody was in the room. I'm going to make this announcement very quickly that, and I don't know if there's agencies still here. Agencies? agency. I saw someone from DPS earlier. I would like any additional bill to be considered before this committee to be in the hopper tomorrow for introduction on the House floor on Monday. Then we will take our remaining bills, those new bills that are introduced and those that we already have queued up, including Representative Champions, on Tuesday here at 4:30, on Wednesday at 1, and then we will do an omnibus bill of those bills that have been passed here at 4:30 on Thursday, and then we're pretty much done with our business unless there's Senate legislation to consider the following week. So with that, our meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.